from KQED. Hey there, everyone. From KQED Public Radio, this is Political Breakdown. I'm Marisa Lagos.
And I'm Scott Schaefer. And we here at The Breakdown, well, we are here for the audience, Marisa, despite the occasional monsoon outside.
Yeah, it seems like it's probably good news for the reservoirs, but it's been quite a mess around Northern California and even, I think, Southern California as well. So everyone
Absolutely.
Be careful.
But today we have just the thing to keep you warm and dry.
Really?
That's what it says here. Our guest is someone who knows a thing or two about messes, politically.
And baby-related.
Baby-related messes,
yeah.
Too.
Buffy Wicks is a former Obama campaign and administration official, a mom of a super cute toddler, if that's not, like, too unobjective for me to say.
Super cute.
Yeah. And now she is the Assemblywoman representing Berkeley, Richmond, El Cerrito, part of Oakland. It's like a really big district.
It's a big district, yeah. But first we're going to talk, let's talk government shutdown. Pelosi goes toe-to-toe in those pink heels with you-know-who. And also something you are familiar with, Marisa, PG&E.
Yeah, let's get to that in a second. Let's talk about the more fun government shutdown-related news, which is this battle royale between Speaker Pelosi and President Trump. So Pelosi, we've covered her for a while. This was a very Nancy move. She sent this letter yesterday.
Dear Donald,
I was thinking about it. And since 800,000 workers don't have their paychecks.
Maybe you should mail in your State of the Union address.
Yes. I mean, literally. Sadly, given the security concerns and unless government reopens this week, I suggest we work together to determine another suitable date, blah, 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 for the state of the state.
Took them like a day to respond.
Or you could consider delivering it in writing to the Congress, which is how it used to be, I guess.
It was Thomas Jefferson. I'm sure Trump would like to go back to the days of Thomas Jefferson. Yeah, no, I think he's met his match.
Yeah.
In Nancy Pelosi. And what is so apparent or becoming apparent is that her strengths of keeping this really diverse caucus together are really coming through here, because he's tried to, probably figured he could peel a few of them off. He tried to do that. None of them actually took him up on his invitation to come to the White House.
And then he clapped back today. He was like, I'm sorry to inform you that we're going to cancel this thing nobody knew about. She was supposed to go to Afghanistan. And he did say in the letter, if you want to, you can fly a commercial.
Right.
Which I'm sure the Secret Service or whoever protects Congress would be super stoked.
I'm sure United flies to, Kabul. But the other thing was, he said, we're canceling your trip to Egypt. And then Pelosi's press person said, we're not going to Egypt.
Bad information.
Anyway, fake news.
I mean, yeah. I do think that the speaker has a point, which is that the state of the state would be pretty incongruous at a time of this government shutdown, given the sort of spectacle that it is. And you do wonder how, if she hadn't done this, sort of how it would have worked.
I would guess that half of them wouldn't have been there, or more than half.
Yeah, right.
It would have been sort of
just not show up.
Yeah. And, who knows? But I think I'm still thinking this is going to get resolved now. I think he's real. I'm looking at his poll numbers this afternoon, on Real Clear Politics. They're kind of starting to drift down a little bit, which is what he cares about more than anything, is winning and numbers, poll numbers. So we'll see. We'll find out.
Well, I mean, and we know that the impact in California is still being felt. People are vandalizing Joshua Tree, which is like
somebody cut down a Joshua Tree.
Why would you go there and do that? I don't understand. And then we've been hearing some rumors. Our colleague John Sepulveda confirmed one today that's a little interesting about the Coast Guard.
Yeah, he has a source in the Coast Guard, a 20-year veteran, who said that some of the contraband that they are collecting, the Coast Guard, including drugs, like they have nowhere to send them.
These barrels or bushels of cocaine.
So
apparently
there's
bushels
of drugs. Bushels. Binders
full. Drugs. Anyway, so back here in California, though, we've also had a pretty exciting political week. But down in LA, unfortunately, the teachers are still on strike. Big sort of political roller coaster there. I mean, one thing that has really hit me, and tell me if you agree, but is just how it seems like in California, every single politician has basically almost without fail position themselves on the side of the teachers. They probably know Buettner, the superintendent of LA schools, and have relationships, but it just seems like when you see every statement from the legislature, they're like out there on the picket lines saying,
haven't seen many Republicans doing that.
That's true, but
Yeah.
There's not a
yeah.
ton
no,
of
No, I think, you know, and of course, people have been asking the governor about that. But it's a bigger problem, of course, for Eric Garcetti, the mayor of Los Angeles. He doesn't have control of the school district, of course, but he's trying to, you know, get to Iowa and New Hampshire every now and then. So I'm sure he'd like to get that result.
Yeah. And then, as you mentioned, the biggest news, I would say, of the week that I've been following was this PG&E intention to file for bankruptcy and sort of these looming questions about our utilities and the future there and what it means for Governor Gavin Newsom.
Yeah. And of course, you know, we talked to Governor Gray Davis earlier in the week because he went through something similar in 2001.
And then he lost his job.
Different circumstances for sure. But, you know, as we were talking earlier, Marisa, you know, Rahm Emanuel used to say, never let a good crisis go to waste.
How'd that work out for him?
Yeah, how did that work?
Chicago.
Well, yeah. Well, we'll talk with our guest about some of that in a little bit. But, you know, I was thinking, though, there's talk about all kinds of things, including, you know, making it a public utility. And I'm thinking, you know, Newsom's slogan was what? Courage for a change.
Yeah.
Right. So
let's
see what that looks like.
Yeah. I mean, I think that's probably not very likely that like the government would fully take it over. But I do think that this presents an opportunity for this governor to stand up and be a leader and try to get these parties to the table. And I think maybe be a little stronger in this area than we saw Jerry Brown.
And get stronger oversight. Also from the CPUC and, you know, perhaps some other body as well.
Yeah, so we'll be watching that. We do know that he has one appointment to the 5-member PUC, so not a game changer there. But, you know, I think this next few weeks it'll be fascinating to see. But we're going to take a break right now. And when we get back, we will talk to Assemblywoman Buffy Wicks. You're listening to Political Breakdown from KQED Public Radio.
And welcome back to Political Breakdown. I'm Scott Schaefer here with Marisa Lagos, and we're excited to have the new East Bay Assemblywoman Buffy Wicks in the studio. Buffy, welcome to the Breakdown.
Hi, guys.
Hey.
Hey there. So I want to ask you, you were sworn in. We were there the day you were sworn in a few weeks ago.
I was in the Senate, actually. Sorry.
It's okay.
I was there. And you had with you your family, your little JoJo, your 2-year-old. What was that like for you after having worked so many years to help others get elected, to finally be elected yourself?
It's pretty emotional. You know, I mean, sitting on that, you know, on the floor and you're in this, it's gorgeous in that building, right? I invite any constituents to come up and take a tour, although I'm still learning where everything is. but, you know, the power of the institution is very emotional. And I had that same experience when I worked in the White House. I remember going through the gates and being like, if I don't feel emotional every day about being here and feel honored, then I need to go find some other profession, you know? So in that sense, it was great. And having my daughter there, she's, you know, she's 2. She was with me a lot on the campaign as well. She was about 6 months old when I got into the race. So she's spent the vast majority of her life.
I saw one story where it said that she mimics how you stand when you talk because she's been watching you for so long giving your pitch to voters.
She just like expects now that anytime I'm with a crowd of people that I'm just going to get up and speak. You know,
that's just like, she's like, that's
what
mom.
You do. Yeah, totally. Yeah. And she would like hand mimic me and stuff is really cute. And to be fair, I know a lot of people thought that, or there was accusations that Gavin Newsom planted Dutch running up to the stage. 2-year-olds
you
will just run up.
I have a 2-year-old.
Yeah, you cannot script a 2-year-old, and they will just run up to you. And
I mean, you can let them off the leash, so to speak, I guess, yeah, and like say if you want to go up there, it's
free
fine.
Range. 2-year-olds. Yeah. I want to ask you though, because and this occurred to me when Dutch, the governor's 2-year-old, came running up on the stage or waddling up or whatever he was doing.
Toddling.
Up, not waddling.
He is a toddler.
You know, but it reminded me of how protective of their kids, the Obamas were and the Clintons were. And I wonder if you and Peter, your husband, had any discussions about, you know, how much you wanted to have your kids, you know, if you have another one, but your daughter out in front on the campaign trail and, you know, visible like that.
Yeah, I mean, I think first of all, I wasn't running for president, so I didn't have that same level.
Obama, Bill, Hillary, same thing.
Yeah, totally. So there wasn't that same level of kind of scrutiny, and frankly, for them, safety issues, right?
Yeah.
But for us, it was a lot of just logistical challenges. I mean, JoJo came with me to stuff all the time because she needed to. Who else was going to watch her, you know?
And nurse her.
I breastfed for 18 months, and which was longer than I thought I would, but she was allergic to dairy, so you know, you do what we need to do. And I was lugging my breast pump around, and you know, it was like planes, trains, and automobiles of parenting. So I just brought her with me to a lot of stuff because we really needed to. So she was just part of the campaign, and I think, you know, it's good to see women running for office and incorporating their children into the campaign, and fathers as well. You know, I think it's important.
Yeah, I mean, two things I've given a lot of thought to. One is that I've noticed more male lawmakers as well being more comfortable in just the last couple of years, like bringing their kids up for those, you know, ceremonial days and wanting to talk about it a little more. Mm-hmm. And something that I've thought about a lot, because like I brought my kid to the DNC when he was 5 months old, is like how for people in our generation, it's like more like I feel like, you know, our parents, you had to sort of pretend like you didn't have kids, like, oh, you just go over there. Now it's like almost a mandate to come out and be like, yeah, I'm a parent and this is part
of
it.
Well, and it was interesting because I did get some negative feedback on the campaign trail, and it was from an older generation of people saying like, don't bring your kid with you, you know, and
parenting.
Yeah. It was interesting. I had an older woman.
But if she wasn't there, they would have been like, where's your daughter?
Yeah. Like, don't bring your kid. And then one woman
who's watching her. Yeah.
She said, oh, you say you care about all this early childhood stuff, you know, but you're running for office. How do you like square that? And I'm like, I can be a good parent and also care from a policy point of view about early childhood education.
And of course, they would never ask a man that question.
Yeah. Yeah. Did Peter get that? Anyway.
Yeah.
Well, let's go back a little. We like to talk about kind of where people came from. I know you grew up in the Sierra foothills. In a trailer?
Mm-hmm.
Is that because your dad was for the Forest Service, or was that because of
so
where
my
you guys
my
were?
Dad worked for the U.S. Forest Service for about 35 years, and my mom was a stay-at-home mom, and we lived in a trailer park, and it was like a Forest Service trailer park, and we owned a trailer, which I think is funny. I asked my mom, I was like, how much did that cost? And I think it was like $5,000 or something in like 1976 or something like that. And later in life, when I was in college, they built their dream home, and they'd purchased property when I was like in grade school. So we moved the trailer onto the property. The trailer is still there to this day, and they now rent it out. And I'm like, we have really, the ROI on that trailer is significant.
Did you feel like you grew up without much, or was it just sort of normal in that?
It was, well, Forest Hills, you know, it's not a wealthy place.
Yeah.
It's a very working class community. There are a number of trailer parks in that area. And there's a newer part of that community that's like folks that have kind of fled Sacramento. And so they build nicer homes and stuff. So it's a little bit of a mix. But a lot of my friends growing up, very salt of the earth. When we were younger, my mom decided to go back to school, and she got her degree when I was younger. My brother was younger. And then she went into the workforce, you know, and became a loan officer and started making more money. So we kind of, you know, it was this process, but I kind of watched my mom go through that process, you know.
So were your parents political, and like, when did you get the bug for politics?
You know, I was, I think, political like out of the womb. I mean, you know, and I think, you know, my brother's gay, and I think also growing up in rural California, you know, and watching my brother go through this experience as a gay man, a gay young man in rural California in the 80s was not an easy thing, you know? So I think I was shaped by that, certainly. As I became more political, my mother became more political. And so now
How did she express that?
She, you know, she's always been kind of the community organizer without kind of...
Are they Democrats?
They're Democrats, okay. Yeah.
We always like to ask people.
Yes.
Like, do you have a mixed family or not? You know?
Yeah, no, they're Democrats. You know, although my dad's pretty centrist Democrat, but my mom has become much more engaged politically as she's gotten older.
And so when you were growing up, if I'm not mistaken, your congressman would have been John Doolittle, right?
John Doolittle.
Who was very conservative.
Very conservative. My first campaign ever was against John Doolittle in 1996.
You ran? I
volunteered, and it was one of those things where it was like, we're gonna win, and I like put my heart and soul into it. We lost by like 35 points or something, and I was like devastated, but I loved it. So
yeah. So you moved to San Francisco, became an activist.
Yeah.
Later on,
I after college I moved to DC. I worked on the Hill, and then I came back to California and was living in San Francisco, playing on a gay and lesbian water polo team.
With me,
Scott.
Full disclosure,
yeah. Yes,
among others,
Scott,
many
full
others.
Full disclosure, I do have a bronze medal from the Gay Games from City 2002.
I have to say also, just as an aside, Buffy played the toughest position in water polo, which is called the whole set, right? I mean, usually it's like these
and
6
a co-ed
foot
team.
Four on a co-ed team. She gave as good as she got, let me tell you.
You know,
I can say that with certainty.
Thanks, appreciate it. Yeah,
and it prepared you for the political
career.
Yeah,
exactly.
And so, now you don't have to trim your nails.
So from our research, it seems like the Howard Dean 2004 campaign was your first presidential campaign.
Yeah.
Is that fair?
Mm-hmm.
And we actually watched back that moment where he did the yell and everybody acted like he had just like murdered somebody. It It seems so quaint now.
So benign.
I know. The bar has changed. You know, it's like on the Democratic side where like Howard Dean screams and like Obama wears a tan suit. Like those are our scandals, you know. And meanwhile, Donald Trump is like a full on racist and misogynist. Yeah. So
what did that kind of give you the bug for the bigger presidential stuff? Because you obviously went on to work for Obama and then Clinton.
Well, it certainly gave me a bug for organizing, political organizing. I was an organizer for Howard Dean, you know, low guy on the totem pole, out there door knocking and doing house parties
and stuff. How do you explain what organizing is?
It's a good question. Depends on who you ask. But to me, organizing is really about building power. I mean, in concept, right? And it's about relationship building and engaging people in the political process, whether it's for advocacy or for a campaign. And for me, it's a more authentic way to really engage people in politics. Because, you know, as voters, it's like people are making decisions of who they're going to vote on. And they're like, oh, I've gotten 10 pieces of negative mail about this person and 12 pieces of negative mail about this person. Like, often you're making decisions based on that data information, mm-hmm. which is not a fun place to be as a voter.
It sounds like kind of almost grunt work, right? I mean, it's not glamorous.
It's not glamorous. It's really hard work. But when you can really build a grassroots campaign where people have investment, they're emotionally invested in your candidate or your cause, they're putting their most precious commodity, which is their time, into it, it's powerful. And that's what I loved about Dean and Obama.
I know you put that to good use when you ran for the assembly. I think you had, what, over 200 house parties?
239.
Yeah. So what was it, I mean, you know, jumping ahead now to the campaign that you just won, how is it different for you being an organizer, being a consultant, you know, managing campaigns and being yourself a candidate?
You know, it's I used a lot of what I learned, you know, and I've done all different kinds of organizing. I try to bring that to the table in this campaign. I sort of said, if you don't run a well-organized campaign, like, you don't deserve to ever work in politics again, you know, because it's what I've been doing as a profession for such a long period of time. I mean, in a way, it was a little bit more liberating because, you know, when you're working for President Obama, if you say something wrong, you know, that could have bigger implications for him. But if I say something wrong around my own platform, it's just on me, you know?
Oh, interesting. So there's almost like more and less pressure at the same
time.
There's
more and less pressure, yeah. I mean, the hardest thing, truthfully, really, was the constraints on my family. Yeah. And that's the difficult part, right?
Constraints in what way?
You know, I did 239 house parties. Those were all in the evenings and on the weekends, you know, and so it's just hard, you know, when we're raising JoJo and my husband's got his own job and he's in D.C. a lot. And so we're trying to navigate all of that. And it's a tall order to kind of try to juggle all those pieces. And for me, like, I don't mind working 100 hours a week. I did it for years on presidential campaigns. But when I put those constraints on my family, that's harder, right? The guilt of forcing my husband to go through that and my daughter, you know.
Well, I want to ask you about something, because I know that when you were on the Obama campaign, re-election campaign, so 2012, mm-hmm. that must have been, you decided to freeze your eggs.
I did.
Because you were worried that you may not.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
Stop working those 100-hour weeks. I know you didn't end up actually having to use them, but I don't know. Was that a tough decision? And then, like, you, like, also just going through that process while you're working on a campaign like that must have been kind of challenging.
Yeah. And I went through 3 cycles to do that.
Oh, wow.
Because
everyone
eggs
I hear,
freezer.
Like, says that it's awful.
Yeah. It's not fun. But for me, it felt like it was an empowering choice that I could make. Mm-hmm. Because for me, it was about preserving choices for the future. And the most important choices for the future, which I still may need to draw on those eggs, you know.
How did you explain that to, like, the 20-year-old staffer? Like, don't, like, that's
I was behind pretty, the pizza. I was pretty open about it. You know, the senior staff knew, and it was just what I was going through. We also, the Obama world, like, we're pretty kind of close-knit group of people, and a lot of these are folks I'd been working with for years. So I was just, I mean, I tend to be a fairly open person, and just said, hey, I'm freezing my eggs. I got to go to a doctor's appointment today. It's just it's what it is.
Yeah.
Just a reminder, you're listening to Political Breakdown from KQED Public Radio. I'm Scott Schaefer with Marisa Lagos. We're talking with Assemblywoman Buffy Wicks. Buffy, let me ask you about your name. Buffy.
It's my real name.
It's your real name. Was that a plus or a minus on the campaign?
You know, it's a little bit of a double-edged sword.
Or just in life.
Yeah, there's still moments where I, like, look in the mirror, I'm like, your name is Buffy. Like, that's, I know, right? Like, but at the same time, I sort of believe you kind of have to, like, grow a personality when you, like, have that kind of a name. It's like the song A Boy Named Sue, you know? Like, you just have to kind of own who
you
are.
Where did it come from?
So my aunt that I never met, she was killed in a car accident when my dad was little. Her name was Kitty Joe. And my first name is actually Buffy Joe. Hmm. And they really liked, they wanted to kind of give an ode to her. So they liked the name Buffy. So they added Buffy Joe, which is why my daughter's name is Josephine. So there's the little through line there on the cool. Joe. But they just liked it. They thought, my parents thought, they wanted me to be different. Little did they know what they're getting themselves into. So
no one called you BJ.
No one called me BJ.
Now Scott has on the radio. we are jumping around a little bit here, but I do want to ask you, because you were in the White House or in the administration, like when the ACA passed. Mm-hmm.
Affordable Care Act.
And, Scott's question here is, why did the White House do such a terrible job of selling the ACA? I'll make
you're putting that on me. I can't believe it.
But
that was
our
perception, right?
Yeah. I mean, and you were in the Office of Public Engagement, right?
Yeah.
So it was kind of weird. Like, in hindsight, I guess, do you have, like, if you could go back, you know, do you think there was a way to do that differently?
Are you talking about actually selling the bill or the implementation?
No, the implementation.
Well, selling the law.
Yeah. I mean, I certainly think there was problems with implementation, you know, which we...
Website.
Right,
starters.
Exactly. I mean, it was, we kind of got out of the gate rough. And I wasn't in the administration at that time, but okay. I was, a news
but
follower like everyone else.
Them.
Right, yeah. So I think there were obviously challenges around that, you know.
It's like now super popular. I mean, is
ironic.
That just...
I always thought that was because the benefits didn't really... took a while for people to feel the benefits, whereas they felt the mandate right away. You know,
right,
they felt the downsides of
it. And it just did take a while. And these things do take a while. And the implementation is always like the tough part, right? You can kind of... put out 1,000 great ideas, you can pass bills, but then like actually where the rubber meets the road is the hard part. But it has proven to have worked for millions of people across this country.
I also wonder, like, it's sort of like you see those statistics, how like Nancy Pelosi's super unpopular when she's running for office, but when she's governing, she's fine. Like, it's easier, you know, it's easier to sort of memorialize somebody or something when it's in the past, right?
And there still, by the way, is a lot of work that needs to be done, and we have to build on that, yeah.
Well, but interesting too, that a lot of these Republican deep red states are now expanding Medicaid under ACA because they don't want to leave all that money on the table.
That's
it's
exactly
a smart
right.
thing to do.
All right, well, let's talk about Assembly, right? More?
Yes. I actually have a question about that. So I want to ask you about race. You ran for this seat and you were replacing Tony Thurmond, African-American, mm-hmm. who ran and won, became the school chief. And you're a blonde, white mm-hmm. girl, right?
Yep.
So how did that play out in the race? How did you deal with it? How did you think about it going into the campaign? And what did you have to deal with during the campaign?
I mean, I think for me, what I think voters want most of all is they want someone who's authentic. And who's real and who's going to, you know, not try to hide the ball on stuff. And so I think that's the most important thing for candidates across the board. And especially the voters now, and you look at younger voters in particular, they really want authenticity. And so for me, I tried to embody that in my campaign through the house parties, through, you know, the engagement online. I did a lot of video content, you know, and I do think I had a barrier to overcome in terms of like, I mean, my name is Buffy, right? I mean, it's like, it couldn't get more sort of like, you know, scripted if I tried, right? So I think I just had to be very real about that kind of stuff and just speak from the heart on the things that I cared about. And that's what I think is really, really important. It's what I hope these presidential candidates in 2020 decide to do as well.
When you entered the race, did you think or know that you would be painted as this sort of establishment? Because, I mean, and for our reader or our listeners outside of the Bay Area, maybe, like, I mean, this is a very liberal district. It includes Berkeley and parts of Oakland, Richmond. But it's also like, I mean, only in the Bay Area would you, coming from Obama, be, you know, the sort of the shill for like the big corporations.
Right.
Developers.
Yeah, yeah, no, totally. I mean, I got called the corporate Dem and all these sorts of things, right? And I still think.
And you raised a lot of money.
Right. I still haven't taken any corporate money. So, but, you know, it is what it is. You know, I think part of it is I came out a little out of left field. You know, I get that. I hadn't come from a local elected office. I think almost all of my opponents had.
Right.
So I understand that, you know. I did raise a lot of money. I leveraged every single relationship I've had in politics for the last 20 years. To raise the money that you need to compete. Mm-hmm. And so I did, and then I also leveraged relationships for endorsements, you know, Kamala,
Barack Obama.
President Obama.
Yeah.
Right, exactly. You know, but I also ended up getting like 8 of the 10 mayors in the district. And, you know, but for me, that's why it was very important because all those things sound nice and all. But if you're not in the community, talking with voters, listening to voters, asking what they care about, where they're at on stuff, then none of that other stuff matters. And that's why, for me, the house parties were really important. We also knocked on 115,000 doors in the race. And so those person-to-person contacts are really, really, really critical.
Did you, like, text Obama? Like, how do you get that endorsement?
I'm guessing not text.
I did not text the president.
I don't know. No,
yeah. I don't have that level of connectivity to him. But and just to go back to the other question, I think that, you know, the Bay Area is sort of 50 shades of blue, right?
Yeah.
You know, and I got sort of pigeonholed as that. But if you look at my track record, it's like anti-war organizer, work for Howard Dean, worked in the labor movement, you know. And so now I think, you know, and I know that there are voters in the district who probably weren't pleased with the fact that I won. But, you know, they are my constituents now, and they will hold me accountable, and I'm excited to do progressive things with them.
Well, and I think one of the positions you took, which I think was unique among all those candidates, was you came out, as Gavin Newsom did and John Cox, one of the few things they agreed on, was against Prop 10, against mm-hmm. expanding rent control. Mm-hmm. How much grief did you take for that?
I mean, that was a tough position to take, you know, and it was hard for me because emotionally, like, you know, I see in my district the impacts of what's happening in terms of our housing crisis and people losing, you know, their place and rents going up significantly. But I didn't feel like that was the right solution to the problem. And I will say what I'm doing now, which I said on the campaign trail, is figuring out what are the reforms we can do, what are the other tenant protection things that we can do. And that's a lot of the legislative work that I've been working on now, because I do think our renters need more protections.
Do you think that there's like political will after the trouncing Prop 10 got for any of those changes? Because the real estate industry has been pretty good at the state yeah. level and always of beating that back.
I mean, we are in a housing crisis. And so this is what I appreciated about the pro Prop 10 people is people are angry and they are frustrated. Yeah. And I see it and feel it, and people feel it and see it all the time. And so we have to take that energy and funnel it in the right direction.
You know, I wonder, we have about a minute and a half left. You spent time for Obama in Missouri, mm-hmm. which is a state which in 2008 he almost won. Trump country now, deep red. And I'm just wondering, what do you think, looking ahead to 2020, what yeah. kind of person do you think the Democrats need to nominate?
It goes back to what I said earlier, authenticity. I mean, I think people are allergic to like a talking point candidate. And so the candidates that have that kind of authenticity that are speaking really from the heart on what they believe are the ones that I think are gonna succeed and be successful.
Who would you put at the top of that list so far? I realize it's early.
I have a bias.
Yeah, I was going to say, I feel like if Kamala doesn't come out of your mouth,
if Kamala Harris decides to run, she's my girl. So I think she has those. She has all that. I think she's authentic and smart. And yeah.
But it's tough sometimes too, like putting yourself out there, right? Because you don't often get rewarded for being candid.
It's tough. But if you're not being candid and being truthful about who you are, then why are you doing it? You know, and even if you do have to take tough positions on things, what I learned in the race is I can't be all things to all people. And I'm never going to be. And if I'm trying to be all things to all people, then I'm going to be a bad elected official, you know? And so I think that rings true if you're running for school board or if you're running for president of the United States.
All right. We're going to have to wrap
Leave
it up
it
here.
That.
Any more water polo
That was
for you?
Fast.
I know.
You guys are great. Let's keep doing this.
All right. Come on back.
Come back to the pool.
Thank you, Assemblywoman Buffy Wicks, for coming in.
Thanks, guys. Thanks for
Good
having
me. Good to have you.
All right. Well, that will do it for this edition of Political Breakdown, a production of KQED Public Radio. Our producer is Guy Marzorati, and our engineer is Steele Muller.
Ethan Lindsay is our executive editor. Holly Kernan is our chief content officer. I'm Scott Schaefer. You can follow me on Twitter. I'm at Scott Schaefer.
I'm Marisa Lagos. You can find me on Twitter. I'm at MLagos. That's a wrap for this week's Political Breakdown. We'll see you next week.
See you next time.